public duty as well as a personal duty of theirs to play fair by their employees and so on, but they accepted capitalism as a system without any question or doubt. Don't forget, something was a shock to people in Ceylon when a labor government was first formed in Great Britain. Then they got disappointed also, because they thought now a labor government would be strongly anti-imperialist and would be in a great rush to liquidate the British Empire. Well, they found that actually labor was only a little more liberally inclined than the liberals had been. No question of immediate liquidation.
If I insist that point you made that they prided themselves on the fact that they were different from India, how can I substantiate that document? Something you have picked up in general knowledge?
No, no, no. You see it stated in so many words, shall we say. In practically all the memoranda that were presented in 1908, beginning with James Pearson, you find it over and over again in the speeches, even of the Ceylon National Congress, where they've gone so far as to take a name which was deliberately copying India. They said, but we are setting about this in a better way. In other words, our leaders were speaking with the voice of the moderates and even the liberals, as they were called in India. Certainly not with the Congress, with the leaders who were much more radical.
Last few is really the sort of the business of the origins of some of these nationalist families or individuals, shall I say. I was wondering whether offhand you can recall any whose wealth and therefore through wealth, education and sort of depended on, say, Arak and Toddy Renke. I know the DSS, of course.
I'm afraid I don't know any others.
Any in the Tangor area?
No leading politician came from there. They are the representatives in the legislative council and so on, but almost always good, solid lawyers. Mm-hmm. A man by the name of Vikram Nayaka, B.S. Vikram Nayaka, was over and over again listed there. And in Mathura again, you get even lawyers.
B.S. Vikram Nayaka, now how did his father make money? Did he depend on his father or was it through his own
family? No, I think mainly he came from the Gaul family and settled down in Tangaul, where he would have less, I suppose, professional competition. Built himself up there.
What about the other line? Sort of Plumbago, purely Plumbago, so the Kathalavalas, Sennai, Artigalas.
Are the Artigalas going to meet? I don't know what the Artigalas. But Plumbago and Sennai were certainly.
Meet any Artigalas?
Yes. Well, that's, after all, Plumbago is almost confined to this northwestern province, isn't it? No big deposits. I don't think there are big deposits.
Headman families?
Oh, yes.
Many of
them. They count, certainly. And in the south also, the Rajapaksas and Jayawardena? Harry Jayawardena is definitely a very well-known Mudaliar in the south. He's a Professor Bibile's grandfather.
Maharaja, and did any of his sons go into politics or something?
No, but he himself dabbled in it and contested the Sikh Gurdwara.
How would I identify Harijai was? Harijai was of what? Of Bibile or?
No. Of the Girava Patru.
Of course, Alivhyar is, Munamal is that line.
Alivhyar is really begin with Bernard, as far as politics is concerned.
Yes, but they are.
Oh, they are prominent, certainly, yes.
And there were some others that I could. Well, Guru Madhana, Mallamuri is
Oh, yes, certainly. And there were after. But
apart from Harijavan, you mentioned someone else in that province?
Rajapaksas. This whole crowd of DM and DA, Rajapaksa, and now their sons are carrying him the second generation.
Rajapaksa of what then?
Valas,
DM and DA Rajapaksa?
DA are the sons of Muddiya in
Muddiya
Rajapaksa of Valas Pola, and plenty of lands in that area around Veerakati and so on. I think that family at one time held about 5 of the seats. On the uncles and nephews.
That's in the 30s or
no, 50s? No, in the 50s. Held about 5 of the seats. But then they were helped by the respect for the family, but they were all virile chaps who had plenty of ideas and plenty of energy.
What caste?
Going on.
Yes, the Mudaliya families tend to be that.
Yes.
Too. But yeah. What caste would he have with him? This is very interesting.
I don't know.
The Munasingha Goigamas now, but A.P. Soyuza says that they are Dura.
I just don't know too much about caste. When you put the question even about the Rajapaksas, you were a schoolboy here. I always took it for granted that they were Goigama. I wouldn't be absolutely sure.
Because now Lakshman Rajapaksa,
yes,
I know one of them is a minority caste, one of them.
Well, they are brothers, he may have got married to those chaps while they owed their position to a certain extent to caste, didn't cling to the caste idea. They were big enough and forward looking enough to reject the caste idea for themselves. But as I said, I may be mistaken, though I don't think so.
Any people, of course, mostly the Muslims, as of any who made their money in the jewel trade, gem trade. Now, you said the Rajapaksa's own land. What land? Was it paddy plus? I suppose, did they have any estates?
Estates meaning modern land is...
No, I mean coconut.
They would have had a certain amount of coconut land, mainly paddy land. Mm-hmm. And a good deal of land was when it comes to chenar cultivation. But it's not just their land, it's more their position that they were over and over again. Mudaliyas chosen, Mudaliyas and Mahanthas chosen on that family.
But I was just wondering to what extent headmen were able to fructify their wealth, you know, to improve their position. They would have inherited a certain amount of land, position, status. Did they, from generation to generation, if they were not careless, were they able to use their position to expand
their wealth? I think most headmen after all in Ceylon did something much better than that. They used it to build up their influence. And very often in the very finest possible way. by definitely identifying their interest with these people. They wouldn't waste their money in just profusely helping every cause that arose. They would help the causes, but they work for them and establish their contacts, and always willing to help with good, dispassionate and disinterested advice. And most important of all, I think, was the sheer time and energy and thought which they give to every kind of welfare project.
To sidetrack somewhat, to what extent was the partition ordinances being used to increase landholdings? I mean, especially I was thinking of proctors, maybe some notaries and others, using this as a method of evicting
people. Well, my father was a proctor, and to him, a partition case meant that land is, so to speak, in chancery for 40 or 50 years. That it's everything is ruined, everything is held up because the procedure is so tedious that nobody can do anything really worthwhile with the land. And a partition action, above all things, is something which a good proctor would try to avoid and seek to bring about some understanding or compromise among his clients.
Because civil servants I met said that some of the noted land grabbers and people like Kurdes or not used this as one method by which they gained a foothold and eventually got the land. But I was wondering to what extent it prevailed. Now, if it took a long time, really, it would hardly be worth their
while. And also, remember, after my recollections, my experience, such as it is of a relatively much poorer area than the Satpur, northwestern province. Was one of northwestern province and Sabaragamu were supposed to be the two richest of the provinces of the Canadian Kingdom. Well, down there in the south, particularly the southeast.
On the other hand, I recall that recently Colvin R. made a crack about the partition ordinance, somewhat on these lines that it was used as a... And he should know.
He should. But...
I think it's curious, probably.
How far were the safeguards which led to these delays discarded in precisely this generation? Now I'm just speaking. Weren't there important amendments of the partition ordinance, partition laws, in the 1920s? I don't know. Don't say that I'm saying it.
Because the delays, in a sense, work to the advantage of the bigger men, always.
The impression I got
is that these people instituted partition cases. Once they instituted, nothing could be done. And then they sat on it and got it postponed as much as possible. While they were using their position and wealth and so on, sometimes they may have cultivated the thing themselves. They may have expropriated it, that land, and were using it. And therefore, the partition case meant that no one could do anything about it.
I thought the chief thing that a partition case would do was the chief reason why it brought things to a standstill was not that you were enjoined not to do a thing. If you were already in possession of some land, you could work on it. But you would be discouraged from spending any capital in improving it. That I would have thought was the main thing. And if that was so, I don't see where the big man was going to put his money in. It would be risky. He may have used the partition case as a means for buying out the spot.
Yes, that's right.
That's a difference, though.
Yes, that's right.
Induce him to surrender his claims for a money consideration, which sometimes was inadequate.
Yes.
That's a difference, though. That I can understand.
I think that's right. I couldn't recall it.
It's
about 8 or 9 co-partners. They just got hold of one of the shares.
Yes.
And then used the partition case to force the others out. Mm.